Les colloques du Collège de France.
Well, dear colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. It's a bit early to start, but you all know we have a very long trip. We're going to outer space. And I'm delighted to welcome you on this trip which starts at the Collège de France for this two-day conference on property in outer space. This conference opens the series of lectures I'll be giving this year on the concept and conceptions of sovereignty in international law. Outer or extra-atmospheric space is an interesting context in which to think about sovereignty, because it's a space that is not only extraterritorial, like other spaces, such as the high seas, the deep seabed, or the Arctic, but it's also extraterrestrial altogether. Accordingly, it's even more remote from the ways in which we, human beings, have designed the law and politics of the public and private life of peoples on a given territory. Outer space, therefore, seemed to me like a good place to explore how the concepts of sovereignty, jurisdiction, and property have been tied to one another in international law ever since the 17th century. It also seemed like a good place to explore how they could be tied differently to one another in the future, or how we could even untie them altogether. This, at least, is the promise I saw in this conference topic. In practice, however, and you know this, the proprietary logic that runs deep inside the modern foundations of international law is difficult to uproot. And the contemporary scramble for celestial resources has reactivated all the principles of modern natural law of peoples, those very same principles that have justified our state's constant expansion through international law since the 17th century. Far West, new frontiers, human settlements, safety zones, enclosure, resources, so are the terms now commonly used when addressing the outer space. My hunch, however, is that it's not too late to react. Hence the conference illustration that you can now admire here on this big screen. As you can see from this drawing, the drawing refers to a human being reaching out with his hand into outer space. It's a human hand that grabs in order to use, exploit, and own, of course, but it's also a human hand that grabs maybe simply in order to explore scientifically and to think and organize differently. It is this other, latter form of human grabbing, one that makes the exploration of outer space the matter, the object, or to quote Article 1.1 of the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, the province of all mankind, that animated me to bring you all together in the same room for the next 2 days. In those introductory remarks, I'd like to do 5 things. First, clarify the context of this conference. Second, identify the questions we will discuss. Third, explain the perspectives from which we will be addressing those questions, because they'll be very diverse. Fourth, specify the objectives, the broader objectives of the conference. And finally, say a few words about the way it's organized. So let me start with the context. The strengthening of scientific research and technological capacities in outer space, together with the parallel intensification of both public and private explorations aiming at future commercial or military use thereof, have key strategic implications. We all know this. But what people know less, I think, is that those developments have also put the existing legal basis in international space law to test. They've revealed their gaps, indeterminacies, and contradictions. More specifically, the prospects of space mining and other forms of private explorations and use or exploitations of celestial bodies have given the question of property in outer space a renewed urgency. Excuse me. In short, and everyone will have to define this for his or her own, what I will mean here by property in outer space is the ensemble of domestic real, mostly private, but also public or other, property rights that could and should be over celestial bodies and or extracted materials, with all the public and private international law implications such rights give rise to. Now, in principle, as it is the case in other spaces under international law, a non-appropriation principle applies to outer space. And this since the 1960s and the adoption of the Outer Space Treaty, you have Article 2 now on the screen. So this would seem to solve the question. Despite later clarifications in the 1979 Moon Agreement, states still disagree, however, about the scope of this principle of non-appropriation. The disagreement pertains to both its material scope. Does the principle apply to celestial bodies only, or both to those bodies and the extracted resources? It pertains to its personal scope. Does it cover only public appropriation in the form of sovereign claims by states, or both public and private appropriation under national law, by means of use or otherwise? States also disagree about the implications of the second complementary and this time much more positive principle that was added in the 1917 Moon Agreement, and you have it now on the screen, the principle of common heritage of mankind. Does the principle of common heritage of mankind, that is much more positive than the non-appropriation principle, merely restate the content of the non-appropriation principle, albeit positively? Or does it qualify the principle by authorizing private appropriation, provided it is either done in common, and hence as common property, or at least for the common good somehow? States also disagree about the contents of the further principle of equitable access and sharing of benefits that was introduced in 1979 as well, in the same provision. Indeed, that principle could apply to the common exploitation of celestial resources once it's been organized according to the regime foreseen by the agreement. And so states ask the question, does that principle indirectly authorize public and or private appropriation of celestial resources, provided the extraction is organized and exploited in common? In any case, due to the limited number of state ratifications of the Moon Agreement, 17 to date, by opposition to the 117 states parties to the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, the Moon Agreement is not considered by most states as an expression of universally binding customary law, and this is something we will discuss in the conference. And the same thing seems to apply to the international regime for the common exploitation of the natural resources of celestial bodies that is foreseen by the same agreement, but has not yet been specified and organized by its states parties. Now, this disagreement about the meaning and scope of the non-appropriation principle in international space law has been sharpened recently by the tensions between those two more recent principles, i.e. non-appropriation by means of use and the common heritage of mankind, and older, much more original principles in the international law of space that have applied to all areas beyond national jurisdiction since the 17th century. Those principles, those original principles of space law, one could say, are the freedom of exploration and use that you find in Article 1.2 of the Outer Space Treaty that you now have on screen, and its twin principle, which is at the core of this conference as well, the freedom of scientific investigation in paragraph 3 of Article 1. Those very ancient, original modern principles of space law have been left untouched by the newer principles of non-appropriation and common heritage of mankind. But this is extremely puzzling for us international lawyers, as those principles seem to accommodate the possibility of free public and private appropriation of extracted resources through use, provided, and this is new, that that use is carried out for the benefit and the interests of all countries. Beyond the latter qualification in Article 1.1, no clear articulation between these four seemingly contradictory principles in outer space law was attempted by either of the two treaties. Now, these indeterminacies and tensions in the interpretation of the non-appropriation principles, and I've been quite brief, and we will be discussing them in detail in the next 2 days, coupled with the development of new technological capacities in space mining, have led certain states to fill the void. States and the lawyers working for those states don't like voids. Some of them have adopted domestic, public, and/or private legislation. Others, sometimes the same, have developed transnational, public-private, soft law instruments. And yet others, sometimes the same, have concluded binding and non-binding bilateral agreements, such as the ensemble constituted by the series of non-binding Artemis Accords concluded by the US with more than 50 other states. What all those domestic, unilateral, transnational, and serial bilateral international legal efforts have in common is an encompassing interpretation of the non-appropriation principle so as to render the exclusion of sovereignty claims in outer space compatible with commercial spatial exploitation and its related with private property rights over extracted resources. And this comes very clearly from Section 10, 2 of the Artemis Accords, which you now have on screen. The aim of those different attempts to develop domestic, transnational, or serial bilateral international law on property rights in outer space is to secure the investments of private companies registered in and authorized by those states to explore and use celestial bodies and their resources. But in the long run, those states' hope is also to shape, through their new unilateral, transnational, and serial bilateral practice, the future interpretation of the 1967 Outer Space Treaty. A treaty, by the way, that is still ongoing, a very active ratification practice these days. So this is something we can discuss later. The hope is that this new practice will consolidate a new customary international law corpus pertaining to property over space resources and maybe lead to a new multilateral regime and a new set of institutions. Now, such an enterprise is not without precedent in the regulations of spaces in international law. Indeed, this is exactly what some states did post-1982 after the adoption of the United Nations Law of the Sea Convention. Following the disagreements about the organization of the international regime for the common exploitation of the deep seabed resources in the convention. What it did then is that through a series of bilateral agreements, they steered that regime slowly but surely towards the 1994 compromise and the modification of the convention that ensued. This is arguably, and this is something we will have to discuss, what led that regime to its contemporary deadlock and to the current laissez-faire in deep seabed extractions. So much for the background. Now, what are the issues or questions we want to ask in this conference? Well, what should be clear from this brief presentation of the context is that one way or the other, the issue of property in outer space is about to be settled an international law. So the issue is not whether there will be an international legal settlement of the issue of property in outer space, but how, where, and what. How should this new international settlement on property in outer space be articulated with the other applicable principles in international law, some of which I've just presented? Where and through what processes should this new international legal regime of property in outer space be adopted? And what legitimate institutions should it give rise to? And finally, third question, with what specific content? Those are the three sets of issues addressed in this conference, and our debates will be articulated around them. Addressing the first issue of the how implies clarifying key concepts that lie at the origin of modern international law and are still beating strongly at its core: sovereignty, jurisdiction, and property. And addressing an even more debated and largely unresolved issue since the 17th century, as I mentioned before, that of the exact articulation between those three concepts, and especially the priority of public sovereignty and jurisdiction over private property. The Gordian knot in the contemporary determination of the international law regime of property in outer space may indeed, and this is what I submit to you, be said to lie in the conjunction of three founding features of modern international law, exemplified in the work of Hugo Grotius in particular. First, the positive institution of territory in international law against the negative definition by default of any other space as being what is not yet enclosed or bounded, but could be enclosed or bounded in the future. This is exemplified by the freedom of exploration and use that has justified the constant expansion of states into such spaces ever since, starting, of course, with the high seas. Second dimension of this Gordian knot, the natural and pre-legal conception of property by labor, use, or occupation, and its independence not only from public sovereignty, but also from state jurisdiction and the law. Indeed, the endorsement of John Locke's natural theory of property by Grotius has reinforced and contributed to the imperialist expansion of states into not yet enclosed territorial and not territorial spaces ever since the 17th century. A third dimension of this Gordian knot, the public and private analogies and the entertained hybridity or confusion between property and sovereignty. Those analogies have indeed supported, once again, the imperialist expansion of states even further by granting states property-like sovereign rights, and conversely, by granting sovereign-like property rights to corporations. Now, as I explained earlier, the introduction of the principle of non-appropriation and of common heritage of mankind in the 1960s international law of space has not displaced this conceptual setup of modern international law. As a result, the proprietary logic underpinning modern international law is still very much in place, and it's facilitating, when it is reactivated, the current claims to property in outer space. This is best exemplified by the notion of commons, which we will be discussing in this conference a lot. The notion of commons is used to refer interchangeably to spaces, resources, or goods in international law, usually bringing an economic understanding of public or common goods in its wake. When commons are defined differently from economists by reference to the original notion of res communis, those definitions of res communis still struggle between the res communis' many contradictory meanings ever since the origins of modern international law. Those meanings have ranged very differently from the commonly owned that may be appropriated individually through labor or use. This is how it was understood by Grotius. The collectively owned that may not be appropriated privately. Or yet another meaning, the non-appropriable, either in private or in common. So as you can see, this conceptual setup and the articulation between the different aspects of the setup is our very first issue. Regarding the where and the second question, i.e. the right type of international space lawmaking, questions of property in outer space are clearly matters for all of us to decide in international law. This is well captured by the many references to equality and to all countries in Article 1 Outer Space Treaty that you now have on the screen. This concern for multilateral cooperation actually explains why the Legal Subcommittee of the United Nations Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space, COPUOS, established a working group on legal aspects of space resources activities in 2021. But difficult political legitimacy issues arise regarding the making of this new international law of property in outer space, and especially with respect to the following questions, for instance. How could its international democratic legitimacy be secured, including its universality, its equality, and publicness? And how could we secure the representation of non-state peoples and of non-human living beings, including extraterritorial ones? How about the role given to science and scientists in those lawmaking processes and institutions? How about its compliance with the international rule of law? How about its concern for environmental justice? Or finally, what are the best institutional and procedural ways of ensuring equity therein? So those are the many questions we will ask as part of the second question and the question of the where. Now coming to the third question, the question of the what, the question pertains to the content of the future international law of property in outer space. And this will require clarifying more carefully what we mean by property in international law, and doing so both under public and private international law at the same time. A better understanding of the meaning and scope of the principle of non-appropriation will also have to be provided. And this in turn will raise question of whether certain goods cannot and should not be reduced to appropriable resources, and whether there are or should be limits to extractivism in international law. In this context, the very indeterminate concept of use itself in the Outer Space Treaty will have to be re-examined. In that context, so-called non-use measures that suspend or prohibit the use of outer space, such as exploitation freezes, moratoria, bans, or spatial protected areas also need to be discussed in detail for outer space. Now, a key question, of course, will be the articulation between the new regime of property in outer space and the principle of common heritage of mankind. And there will be lots of discussions of this in the conference. Now, all three issues regarding the future international law regime of property in outer space, how, the where, and the what, pertain to the exploration and use of outer space, as mentioned in paragraph 1 of Article 1 of the 1967 Outer Space Treaty that you now have on the screen. Accordingly, if you read that phrase until the end, you'll see that the exploration and use of outer space is considered by the space treaty as the province of all mankind. Now, it is because this qualification, that is as striking as it is elegant, captures the conference proposal that the issue of property in outer space is indeed a matter for the whole humanity to settle, that it has also given the conference its first title. And you can see here the title of the conference again. I added a question mark to the province of all mankind, however, to signal that it's being a matter for all mankind is still contested. In fact, I would like to argue that this ambiguity was there from the outset, in the notion of province, in the expression province of all mankind itself. This is confirmed by the different linguistic versions of the 1967 Outer Space Treaty. Not only is the English term province not as clear as the German term Sache for matter, the Spanish term incumben for concern, or the Italian prerogativa or French appanage for competence, but the French etymology and original meaning of appanage and the English etymology and original meaning of province actually also have a quasi-proprietary ring for the former and a quasi-sovereign ring for the latter. Indeed, for a very long time, and this will be discussed again by Jonathan Wiener, they corresponded to private real rights that were not quite property rights, and to public territorial rights that were not quite sovereign rights, but extensions thereof that aimed at compensating for the lack of proper property rights and for the lack of proper sovereign rights of non-heirs to a domain or a kingdom. And this is actually, I'd like to submit, the very kind of quasi-property or quasi-sovereignty claims that do not amount to private or public appropriation that seem to be at stake in outer space, or at least this seems to be the promise of Article 1.1 of the Outer Space Treaty. So this brings me now to the perspectives. You have an idea of context, you have an idea of the three issues we want to discuss. Let me now say the perspectives we want to apply to this topic. Property in outer space has been discussed in international space law for some time, but the topic has grown exponentially in the last 10 years or so. What makes this conference hopefully stand out, and we'll have to see during the next 2 days, is the perspectives chosen to look at the three issues just discussed. First, this is the first conference, to my knowledge, bringing international space law specialists with political philosophers of property into a dialogue. There have been publications on property in outer space by political philosophers in the past, but they're still scarce. In fact, international lawyers and political philosophers do not often confront the approach of property in outer space to that of the other discipline. Thereby, they often miss opportunities, I think, to lift mutual blind spots. A joint law and philosophy endeavor, such as the one proposed here, offers a possibility not only of mutual information, but also of mutual correction. International lawyers often ignore the political philosophical underpinnings of their conceptions of statehood, territory, sovereignty, jurisdiction, or property. Usually they choose the conceptions that serve their argument, or at least assume that the conceptions, and especially the dominant pre-legal, natural, or Lockean conception of property, is the sole possible conception. But the reverse is also true. Philosophers often ignore how rich and diverse, but also how dynamic, critical, and self-reflexive the interpretive practice of international law actually is on those very same issues. Second perspective the conference wants to bring on our topic, the conference is the first one to build bridges between public and private international space lawyers on property in outer space. It is the first one to try to break the silos in which we public international lawyers and they private international space lawyers grow separately. After being very scarce for a long time, publications on the comparative domestic law of private property in outer space and on its private international law aspects are now flourishing. Given the difficulties public international space law currently faces on those issues, and I've discussed them earlier, it's likely that private international lawyers will be the first ones interpreting and moulding international law jurisdictional linkages and other matters in outer space. And after all, this is what they did in other spaces beyond national jurisdiction in the past, as if public international law did not exist. What characterizes most of those publications, however, in private international law or private law of property in outer space, is often their lack of solid grounding in public international law, and especially in the general international law of sources or theories of the rule of law. But of course, conversely, one may also complain about the total lack of understanding of issues of private, domestic, and international law of property by public international lawyers. This is clearly true of the issues increasingly raised by private property rights in outer space, and by extension, of the intricacies and technicalities. Developing a strong private law private international law of outer space is actually, I would like to submit, a requirement of public international law and a requirement of international human rights law. If we want to avoid the private law of property shopping that has now started, then clearly private international law of property is the answer. So these are the two perspectives this conference brings, and I think they will be very fruitful. Now, fourthly, and more quickly, further objectives of the conference. Besides the three very urgent sets of issues I've identified, the conference also has three broader aims. The first one is to question our ways of international lawmaking in general. International lawmaking is currently in a process of deep transformation. It is epitomized by multilateral treaty-making crisis, the development of soft law, by the paralysis of multilateral organization, and by the increasing privatization and technocratic transformation of their processes. And international space law is a paradigmatic example of the current difficulties faced by international lawmaking. While spatial exploration and use are in dire need of a public international law regime, including new multilateral treaties, universal public institutions, they are left, I said earlier, to be regulated by domestic law, non-binding agreement, bilateral agreement, soft law, contracts, and to be governed by resourceful or otherwise powerful individual states, investors, corporations, public-private alliances, and techno-scientific agencies. So the state of outer space law in the context of property invites us to rethink and revisit key aspects of the sources of international law, but also of the legitimacy of international law. A second broader aim of the conference is to question and renew our international legal imaginary itself. We are at a turning point of life on Earth. Most terrestrial spaces have been explored, and most resources are either exhausted or spoilt, thereby threatening the conditions of life. At the same time, with outer space now within human reach, a new space with the unexplored and unexploited resources is opening elsewhere, triggering the return of the proprietary and extractivist logic in the international law of spaces. The fact that those principles can be blamed for global warming, for the depletion of Earth's natural resources, and for the current state of life on Earth does not seem the least to detract the legal proponents from evoking them yet again in their constant search for state and commercial expansion. What I would call a lack of legal imagination is all the more regrettable as the major principles of international law, inspired by Roman private law and adopted, transformed multiple times by modern natural law through analogies with private law since the 17th century, are increasingly being challenged around the world, and rightly so. This calls for a more in-depth questioning of the origins of the main legal categories of our international legal imaginary, to understand where our categories came from, possibly to steer a different future for them. And that future could not only be less European and less Western, but also more comparative and more inclusive and less modern in so many ways, and especially less anthropocentric or even Earth-centric. Third aim of the conference, consolidating, if possible, the international law of science, i.e. the international law that both guarantees and constrains science as an autonomous institutional practice and as a communal and participatory public good. And this brings me slowly towards the end and the transition to the next presentation. Since the 17th century, international law and science have universalized hand in hand. They have offered each other mutual support and mutual justifications in terms of objectivity and in terms of universality in the constant search for expansion to new spaces. And the same thing can now be observed in the expansion to outer space, where scientific or technological capacity and international lawmaking have progressed together and influenced each other again. Nowadays, science is still omnipresent, both in the institutions and norms of international space law, but yet again, it is granting international law the objectivity and the universality that that law can no longer obtain that easily otherwise. So the question of the constraints on what should be the right place of science and of scientists in international lawmaking and institutions is key, but sadly, it is not yet thematized in international space law circles. And the same applies, conversely, to the mirror question of the guarantee and the protection of science by international space law itself, especially in reaction to the privatization of scientific research in a research-driven economy. Think of the legal status of scientific samples collected in outer space. It is totally indeterminate. Think of the importance of local or indigenous knowledge in outer space science and outer space law. A lot needs to be done. So now, finally, a few words about format. The conference is organized around the three sets of issues I've identified earlier. Each set of issues has a thematic panel, and in each panel, you will hear 4 to 5 presentations. The presentations will be made back to back, and at the end of each panel, an experienced commentator, either a human scientist or a lawyer, will be reacting to the papers. Once the commentator has delivered his or her comments, then discussions will take place on all papers together. The conference will close with a general conclusions afternoon. How weird. We will spend the whole afternoon concluding. Why is that? Well, it's because we don't consider general conclusions as a way of summarizing and closing the debate. We consider general conclusions as a way of identifying further issues for discussion, collecting loose ends. And after the general conclusions of Yannick Radi, we will be very lucky this year to have 3 young researchers in our 3 disciplines, public, private, international law, and political philosophy, deliver what they think are the main takeaways of the conference. I would now like to give the floor to my colleague Alessandro Morbidelli, who holds the astrophysics chair, planetary formation, at the Collège de France, and who, besides being an astrophysician, is also the coordinator of the PEPR Origins of Life research project. This research project is actually the reason we're here today. You can see the logo right at the end on the final right corner of the screen. This project is the reason we're here today, and the project is actually funding this conference. So Giving this transition to Alessandro Morbidelli's presentation on resources in outer space is giving me the opportunity to thank him very warmly, thank him and the project for their generosity. I'm sorry I've been too long. I hope this was more agreeable than listening to Trump at the UN. Have a great conference. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.